This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Ambassador Ron Newman, former ambassador to Algeria, Bahrain, and Afghanistan, and currently president of the American Academy of Diplomacy, and also has the very unique distinction of serving as ambassador to Afghanistan, which your father also did, and the only other father-son pair to serve as ambassadors to the same country is
John Adams.
John Quincy Adams. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you for asking.
It's a very exciting interview for us. We're much anticipated and lots to talk about. So perhaps we'll start with your time in Afghanistan and then talk a little bit about what you're doing now.
Okay. I first went to Afghanistan when my father was ambassador. My wife and I went out in 1967, traveled all over the country, saw it in the days when you could travel everywhere really peacefully. I mean, we traveled with no guards, often by ourselves.
Wow.
I went back as ambassador in 2005, although I had kept in touch to some extent with Afghan things through my father, because he stayed very involved after he was ambassador. Mm-hmm. I was ambassador there till 2007, but I started going back in 2010 because I still write and comment on the situation, so I've been back 10 times since.
Wow.
And the last time in October of last year.
Okay.
Kabul, Herat, when we had more troops, I could get out around the country more.
Yeah.
Last couple of visits, not quite so much, but I see a lot of people when I go back, so I don't get too far out of date.
And when you go back, what strikes you the most as different or even not different from your time there as ambassador?
Afghanistan's a really complex place, but one of the things that strikes me so much is the development of the younger generation, mm-hmm. the 20s and 30-somethings that are now educated, some in the States, some other places in the world. There's a whole crop of people who are not part of the war generation, who want a different future for their country, who are incredibly competent. It gives you the feeling that if we can survive the short run, the long run looks pretty good. One of the other things is the development of knowledge about a lot more mineral resources than we knew about. We were just beginning that stuff mm-hmm. when I was there, so that there's also more economic base for the future than we knew about. And the third thing is the development of the Afghan, and most importantly, the development of the Afghan security forces. Oh. They still have lots of problems, it's perfectly true, but there's a good side too. They have not fallen apart. It's
right.
not been like Iraq where they dropped
mm-hmm.
their weapons and ran away.
Mm-hmm.
They lost, you know, it's important to remember two things. One, we only began to build a big Afghan army in 2009, really in 2010. People think because we've been there since 2001 that we've been building an army all this time.
Right.
It's not true. When I left, our target was only 80,000.
Wow.
For the Afghan army. We didn't make the decisions to go big until 2009, didn't begin to fund it or do it till 2010. Mm-hmm. So this is a much more recent development than people understand.
Absolutely.
Second thing to understand is last year alone, the Afghan army had more people killed than we have had in Afghanistan in 14 years. And this is evidence that they are fighting.
Yeah.
Now, they're not always fighting brilliantly, but sometimes they are. They took a real shellacking at Kunduz, lost a city last year, but they got it right back. Mosul
right.
was lost, and it's still in
right.
Islamic State hands. So there's a lot of bad news. There's good news, too. Afghanistan is the kind of place where it's so complicated that if you have really strong views, you can go and find a cherry pick the pieces that will support your view, whatever it is. So somebody who's really against the war can go and come back and say, I was there and this is what it's like. And then somebody who's a big supporter of the war can go and see many of the same things and come back and say, we're winning this war and this is what it's like.
Right.
I think the truth of the matter is we're not winning. We're in a lot of trouble, but it's not hopeless. Some of that is an Afghan problem and fault, and much of it is the fault of our administration.
Really? And what makes you say that?
Because we have rushed. First of all, we've rushed to get out. Hmm. So that there are things that we were never going to finish by this time that we haven't finished that we're leaving undone. Biggest one is the development of an Afghan Air Force.
Hmm.
We had never intended to finish that Afghan Air Force by now, but we've pulled our own air cover. So unless Afghan units are about to be overrun or American or NATO troops are in danger, we won't bomb. So Taliban can move freely. They can mass for an attack. We can see them massing. And in most cases, our Air Force does not have authority to strike them. That leaves the Afghans in a pretty difficult position. Our rationale for that, the official rationale, remember, I'm out of government, but the official rationale for that is that we're no longer in Afghanistan. I'm sorry, that's a political sophistry. We still have people on, we still have over 10,000 troops in Afghanistan, and the Taliban would like to kill as many of them as they can, as fast as they can, and we can kill them on alternate Thursdays when it fits our rules, but we're trying to insist we don't have a war. This is absurd. Some of the complicated things like logistics need a lot of work.
Yeah.
We only began working on a logistics system in about 2011. 2010, we built infantry to get them in the fight.
Mm-hmm.
We have pulled our advisors down to the point that we don't send advisors below the Corps level. That's big unit.
Right.
So we're not sending advisors down below that brigade, battalion, to find out. We don't know whether their system is broken or not,
right.
So we can't help fix it.
You can't know the system if you've not been
so,
on the bottom.
That doesn't mean you need those advisors forever.
Mm-hmm.
It means that they're just pulling out a little too fast for the job that needs to be done. And we could give the Afghans a lot better chance if we just slowed down a little bit.
So that's a great point for our next question, which is, what do we do, right? We're not in a hopeless place, like you said, but we're in some trouble and there's work to be done. So what's our next step?
First step, of course, is to recognize it. It's really hard to make a decision if you're pretending the situation is different than it is.
Absolutely.
Secondly, I think the administration has to answer to the American people, what are we there to accomplish? What's at issue? Before
mm-hmm.
just, you know, people like me who have a lot of skin in the game wanting you to do more.
Right.
And I think the first things to understand are Taliban is still in the country. In fact, they are tightening their ties. I'm sorry, Al-Qaeda is still in the country. They are tightening their ties with the Taliban. We've just seen evidence of that.
Right.
Islamic State is now there as well.
Mm-hmm.
We will deal with the threat if we let this place collapse. And in fact, what you will have if it really collapses is a huge mess in the middle of Central Asia that spreads instability into Central Asia, into Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, we went there for a war and the other side hasn't quit.
Right.
And it's all very well to say we're tired, we're bored, we've lost interest. But if you leave, they win. And that to them will be a sign that God is on their side. That will be a reinforcement to every terrorist and jihadi all over the world who is willing to be part of a long war against the West. So I think, this, first of all, the stakes are still important.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing to recognize is we don't have to fight this war ourselves. We've got now a big Afghan army police force. They got a lot of problems. We need to maintain our presence, probably at about the level we have now, maybe a few thousand more. We don't need big combat troops. We need to maintain our money, and we need to be resolved to do it probably for rather a long time. Also because one of the problems is that we keep signaling we're leaving. So we keep encouraging the people
right.
fighting against us to hold on because
right.
the Americans are leaving.
Absolutely.
And so we have this problem that on the one hand, we're trying to build something that can last without us, and on the other hand, we keep undercutting the confidence that that will work.
Right.
This is a kind of isometric approach to policy. And you know, an isometric exercise is one in which you work against yourself, get very tired, and go nowhere.
Exactly. And I have to wonder, you know, obviously Afghanistan is not the only place you've been ambassador to.
It was my fourth war, actually. I also served in Iraq for 16 months before I went to Afghanistan, just in case you thought I left just in case you thought I left out any of the pleasure spots.
Well, just in case. And my question, I guess, is from your experiences elsewhere and, you know, the specific experience that you had in specific countries, whether it be Iraq, Algeria, Bahrain, or simply the experience of being multiple places outside of the United States, how that kind of impacted the work you did in Afghanistan, how you approached it, and how you think about it now?
Interesting question, hard to answer. I haven't spent all my life in the middle of wars, but
just a good chunk of it.
But I have been, well, I have been in four wars. One as a soldier in Vietnam, as an infantry officer, and three as a diplomat in Algeria in the middle of very bloody years, and Iraq and Afghanistan. And I spent a certain amount of time studying insurgencies. Used to be popular. So I would say one of the things that has informed me is that there are a lot of lessons to be learned, and there's a lot we just don't learn. And some of it's mechanical. Mm-hmm. Years ago, 40 years ago in Vietnam, a fellow named John Paul Vann, who was one of the great experts in that country until he got killed there, said that we don't have 12 years of experience. We have 1 year's experience 12 times. Right. That's still the way we pursue this, with short tours, with very little learning, mm-hmm. And massive rotations of people very quickly so that new people with new enthusiasms can arrive. Now, that doesn't speak to the policy, whether you should be there or not, but it's what you do
once you're there.
Right. I think another thing that I have learned over time is one needs to explain complex situations to the American people, not in thousands of words and fine nuance, but in something more than bumper stickers.
Right. It's bigger than that.
It's a little thicker than that. I find this administration is particularly good at bumper stickers. pardon me. Yeah, well, so you can tell I'm out of government.
Yeah, it's all right. We all are.
Then another thing is, but this is very hard for politicians, is to keep your goals reasonable. Mm-hmm. Whenever we get involved in some situation that involves expenditure of life and risk, mm-hmm. we tend to pitch our goals to a very high standard. Often without saying, what does that require? How long are you going to have to be there to do that? What's it going to cost you?
Right.
And then later, we don't want to say, well, we're really not going to do any of those things, but we're not. And so then you breed discontent. You breed a sense of political failure in the American people because you weren't honest with them. In some cases, because you didn't even bother to think long enough to know, you weren't deliberately dishonest, you're just ignorant.
Right.
But you haven't been honest with people about what you can achieve or how much that achievement requires in time and resources. And so, you know, if I had any lesson to carry it away, it would be that we need a lot more leveling with the American people about actions we get into and about what we're doing about them. And sometimes we have to be willing to say that we're learning, that we can't defend every failure as a success.
Right.
But if everything that doesn't work is failure, then you're risk averse and you never learn. And we have a gotcha culture in our politics, that anything that fails, you go after the people. That was stupid. How could you do such
right.
a dumb thing? But the result of that is that when you go into situations, Afghanistan's one, Iraq's another, but there are lots, where you don't know everything and you don't have a lot of time to study, particularly because it's a war,
right.
then you have to make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be willing to look at decisions as they play out and say, okay, that didn't work. I learned something from that. I go on. Our culture instead moves people, first of all, to deny that something isn't working, to try to deny it as long as possible, because it's going to be career-destroying to admit it rather than to learn from it.
Right.
And so there's a much larger lesson for you.
Absolutely. And you're talking about career lessons outside of just lessons to take away. I know a lot of what you're doing now at the American Diplomacy Center,
American Academy of Diplomacy.
Diplomacy is talking about what the State Department needs to be successful. And would you mind talking to us a little bit about that?
I would love to talk to you
Great.
About that. The American Academy of Diplomacy has now been around for about 30 years. It's a small organization comprising most of the most senior former diplomats.
Right.
Every Secretary of State practically is an honorary member. And its sole function is improving American diplomacy. It doesn't take policy issues. We would never get all our members going.
Oh, I can't imagine. It's much like our consensus, of which you are an esteemed member.
Yeah.
We love you all, but you don't happen to always agree. Though you do on some things.
But we do on some things, and we agree that while we have wonderful people in our Foreign Service, the United States, and in the State Department, that we have some big problems and we're not dealing with them. Mm-hmm. We have a problem from the top that we've become more and more political. This is not a question of just turn the world over to the professionals. It's a question of balance. The one thing that Foreign Service officers bring to the table, particularly very senior ones like Bill Burns, who was recently Deputy Secretary, mm-hmm. rare exception, in having a position like that, is the knowledge of actually having worked issues with foreigners. Doesn't mean you do things the way foreigners want, but it means you understand what it is they want, what's likely to work, what's likely not to work. It's important to have that as part of the mix in policy discussion.
Right.
And the upper floor of the State Department, there are 10 positions, if you count the Secretary of State, the deputies, and the undersecretaries, and three of those out of 10 are professionals. It was only 2 out of 10.
Right.
But one of the 10 is really administrative. So of the 9 that are policy-related, only 2 bring any overseas experience. Mm. And then you see that even more at the NSC, right. which is full of people who have thought big thoughts and almost never done anything with a foreigner. And but, you know, this has been true for years. People say the trouble with American foreign policy is that we have to argue so long with ourselves that we don't really have any
Absolutely.
Time for foreigners.
Right.
So one problem is we're out of balance in the mm-hmm. politicization. Second problem is we're not doing proper education of our diplomats. Mm-hmm. We are the only major country that has no significant education program for diplomats once we bring people into the Foreign Service.
Right.
We have a very rigorous testing process.
Absolutely.
We bring in really good people, but we bring them in from a whole variety of backgrounds, which is great. We want the Foreign Service to look like America.
Right.
But then we don't do anything to equalize the background of somebody who might have been studying for 6 years thinking they wanted to go in the Foreign Service and somebody who suddenly learned about it after they'd been planning to be a lawyer or a teacher. And you need professional education. You need foundation. We don't do that. We give people 7 weeks of rapid training, and we throw them in the field. This used to work. We used to have a much higher ratio of seniors to entry-level people.
Mm.
For a variety of reasons, that's changed. We have 2/3 of American Foreign Service officers have less than 10 years in the State Department.
Wow.
That's an incredible
ratio.
That's
incredible. I mean, when I think about what that would look like at what I would consider the State Department's counterpart, DOD, could you imagine having, you know, military officers, flag officers with only 10 years of experience? It's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
And so we can't stretch the seniors far enough to coach
no.
and mentor the way you could when I came in. Mm. And the result is, again, they need more professional education. They need more training. They haven't argued for it. They haven't funded it. And the Congress, of course, is not interested. I think one of our biggest points is to the Congress, to the American people, to understand that diplomacy is part of our national security.
Absolutely.
That it is key to have people out in the field. When you have a crisis, that's too late to start learning about the country.
Absolutely.
So you really can't say, well, we'll just put them in the places that are important. You know, a few years ago, all of a sudden, the Islamic State blew up in Mali.
Right.
Well, Mali was not on people's radar.
No.
But it was important to have people there who knew something about it when Absolutely. You suddenly found you were getting involved.
Absolutely.
And that's an example of what we need. So.
And I wonder, you know, some of the work ASP has been doing is trying to help people understand, the American public and policymakers, that flag officers, the confirmation process for flag officers is wildly different than it is for ambassadors.
Oh, yeah, they actually get confirmed.
Exactly. And I remember not so long ago, you know, during the African Leader Summit, we were working on some blog posts and letters outlining all of the nations and states on the African continent that we did not have an ambassador in, and they're sitting there in essentially purgatory, frankly, mm-hmm. waiting to be confirmed. And here we are having the African Leaders Summit, and we have no really stable relationship with them. And it's a struggle to make people understand that security is bigger than blowing things up, right? You have to, one, know what's there to blow up, and two, more importantly, try and avoid blowing it up. So what do you think is helpful for people to understand that diplomacy is part of security, that they are the same?
It's a long struggle. There is a sort of unexamined premise that's been there in America for a long time that sort of anybody can do foreign policy if they're basically smart. I mean, nobody would drive on a bridge that wasn't built by an engineer. Nobody would brush their teeth with toothpaste that wasn't certified by a chemist.
Yeah.
But anybody, if they look reasonably bright, should be able to do foreign policy. And sometimes they are. I mean, some of our greatest diplomats have been non-career, as we say, people. But there's an assumption that anybody could do it. So that's a problem. Secondly, we don't, you know, we're a big country. We got a lot of issues ourselves. We don't talk about these things. So it's something that, you know, everybody who's engaged in national policy, think tanks and others, I think just has to keep working on.
Yeah.
And it's never going to be anything except an uphill fight. There's no magic bullet because people...
Right.
Are busy with their own concerns. I remember, this is going way back, but 1969, in Vietnam, I'm an infantry platoon officer, and one of the fellows in my platoon told me that his family had never had a view about Vietnam until he was drafted. Now, that's several years into the war. That's after Johnson had made the war big. That's when we were approaching 500,000 troops in in Vietnam. Vietnam was far bloodier.
Yeah.
We lost more lieutenants in Vietnam than we've lost total combat fatalities in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
But 1969, his family had never thought about it because it wasn't relevant.
It didn't apply to them.
So
interesting.
Keep working because you're not going to finish.
Yeah,
but it is really important.
It's incredibly important. And you know, the last question we ask everybody who's kind enough to come on What's Next is, what happens if... you know, we're wrong or we don't do what we're supposed to do 20 years down the road, what does the world look like? So I ask you, if we don't instill a better understanding of the diplomacy as an aspect, an important aspect of security, and perhaps an education system for our Foreign Service officers similar to what our flag officers go through, what does that look like for America on the world stage?
Well, more problems. But, you know, Churchill said years ago, you can always trust the Americans to make the right decision after they tried everything else.
That's where we're at. There's a great book, if you've not read it, though you may have. It was last published in 1963 or 4. It's called Diplomat Among Warriors. It's an interesting
read. Is that Robert Murphy's book?
Yes,
North Africa.
Yes,
yeah,
it
yeah,
is.
Yeah. No, it's famous.
Well, I'll tell you that my generation could use a good read of that book, and it certainly makes.
Well, I'm
makes
delighted
you
that you know I'm delighted to meet somebody who's not my age who has read that book.
Yes, and, I have my copy. It's a real, not on a Kindle or anything.
You know, I think you're putting your finger on something though that is really for Americans. As a whole, have trouble understanding, which is that intellectualism and force are not separate fields. You know, Socrates functioned as a soldier. Cervantes, who wrote Don Quixote, lost an arm in the battle against the Turks of Lepanto. There is a long tradition of warrior intellectuals. And people who have been on both sides and served diplomatic missions and served in war. And it's a very recent kind of historically ignorant view that these things are completely separate.
Absolutely. And to hear it from the source is exactly what we need. So we'll keep doing what we do. Please keep doing what you do.
Thank you very much.
Ambassador Newman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.